to read to you an excerpt from Grider's book. He said, at the time, he's talking about 1913, at the time, the conventional wisdom in Congress was that the government institution would finally harness the money trust, disarm its powers, and establish broad democratic control over money and credit. The results were nearly the opposite. The money reforms enacted in 1913, in fact, helped to preserve the status quo, to stabilize the old order. Money center bankers would not only gain dominance over the new central bank, but would also enjoy new insulation against instability and their own decline. Once the Fed was in operation, the steady diffusion of financial power halted. Wall Street maintained its dominant position and even enhanced it, which is true. But the other thing that amazed me was Grider's conclusion. He proved that the Federal Reserve had always acted against the public interest. He proved that it was designed to do that from the very beginning. So what do you suppose his conclusion was regarding a solution? That we abolish the Fed? No, nothing that extreme. Well, how about a major overhaul? No, not necessary. What then? Grider said, you see, it's all so complicated. We're learning as we go. We've made a lot of mistakes, but don't worry, folks. We're on it now. Relax. It's under control. All we need now are wiser men. Now, that is the kind of powder puff criticism it takes to be published by Simon & Schuster or any of the other major publishing houses which are firmly interlocked in the investment web on Wall Street. You see, it doesn't make any difference how accurate your history is. It doesn't make any difference how much you point with alarm or how righteous you may sound. If you have no realistic solution to the problem, who cares? They like that, because it gives the people the impression that something's being done. Somebody is really calling attention to the problem. But they have no solution. Or they're carefully selected so that the ones with the real solutions do not get the media, do not get the major publishing houses. This is a tactic which we have to better understand, especially in these critical days ahead. A tactic of controlled opposition makes no difference how accurate you are when you're pointing to the problems in America. If you don't have a solution, what difference does it make? I mean, if your solution is put wiser men in there, or if your solution is vote Republican and don't ask questions about what kind of Republican, you see, well then, you are controlled opposition. And this is something we have to be very, very alert to in these critical days ahead. We're back to the topic. The Federal Reserve System gets an A on its report card for maintaining control over the financial markets in New York. What about reversing the trend toward private capital formation? Boy, did they ever. I mean, they periodically get those interest rates down so low and everybody is lured into the banks. Oh, look at these interest rates. Boy, we've got to hock the house now because this is the time to get in on those low rates, you know. Borrow up to here. And then the economy crunches down and they're all stuck with this overhead. They can't make their interest payments. They're in hock. Well, we've seen businesses go out of existence because they cannot service their debt. We've seen people lose their homes, their cars, because they cannot service their debt. And ladies and gentlemen, do you realize that there are many giant corporations today that are just hanging in there by the skin of their teeth because of their debt overhead? The fact is that many of these companies now send more money to the banks every quarter in the form of interest payments on their loans than they send to their stockholders as dividends on their stock. Think about that for a minute. the banks, which had no part in the operation of the company whatsoever, the banks which made this money out of nothing are making more money from these industries than the people who worked for the money, saved the money, invested the money, and risked the money to own those corporations. And this is because they quite successfully reversed the trend toward private capital formation. And they did it with a flexible currency. The Federal Reserve System gets an A plus on its report card for objective number 2. And finally, did they pass along their inevitable losses to the taxpayer in the name of protecting the people? This is what I call Operation Bailout. Every time one of the big banks gets into trouble, not the small banks, remember, they're the competition, the big banks get into trouble, they're bailed out at taxpayers' expense, always in the name of protecting the people, right? If a large corporation is in trouble because it can't make its interest payments to the bank anymore, they go to Congress and say, we can't let this corporation fold. Look at the thousands of jobs that would be lost. Look how the people would suffer. When a third world country can no longer make its interest payments to a large bank in New York, what happens? The bank goes to Congress and says, you know, you better do something about this, because if we have to write that loan off of our books, we may be bankrupt. We could fold. And look at all the depositors, good Americans, who have their accounts with us that would lose their deposit. Maybe the FDIC won't be able to cover it. We could have a crisis on our hands. If our bank falls, maybe the other banks will fall too. We'll have a national recession. Look how the people will suffer. And so Congress dutifully steps forward. Remember, it's a partner in this, and votes the funds to guarantee the loans, or in some way to pass the payments on directly or indirectly in some very ingenious methods to the taxpayer. And that money is raised primarily through the Federal Reserve System, and we pay it through the Mandrake mechanism. So the Federal Reserve System has done pretty well on that, and in case you have missed a few of the more memorable games, I'd like to review them for you. Penn Central Railroad was bailed out in 1970. That was a good year because Lockheed Corporation was bailed out the same year. Commonwealth Bank of Detroit was bailed out in 1972. New York City in 1975. Chrysler in 1978. First Pennsylvania Bank in 1980. Continental Illinois, the largest of the banks so far, in 1982. And of course, look at all of these third world countries which cannot pay their interest payments. They are paying their interest payments, and you're doing it for them, because the Federal Reserve System creates the money that we send to the International Bank, the International Monetary Fund, and the World Bank, and then they give it to those countries so that they can pay the interest to the banks. Maybe you missed that little trail, but that's how it works. So the Federal Reserve System gets an A++++ on all of these points, and it has surely been a huge success in terms of the people who created it. Well, actions have consequences. And one of the consequences of this scam, ladies and gentlemen, is what we call a national debt. It stands now, well, it's rapidly approaching $5 trillion that we know about. It's much higher than that, because if you include the unfunded debt and all the things that are off budget and all the funny stuff that they do with the accounting in Washington, if it were all honest accounting, you'd find it was much, much higher than that. But even at $5 trillion, it's a staggering figure. I'm told that if we had a stack of $100 bills, about 40 inches high, we'd be a millionaire. But a stack of $100 bills equaling $5 trillion would rise into space 3,350 miles. That's a lot of money. And it all came from us. And it's earning perpetual interest. See? Perpetual interest. Another way of measuring that is that we've had an inflation, a known inflation, of 1,000% since the Federal Reserve System was created. Another way of phrasing that is that a dollar in 1913 today buys about 9 cents worth of goods. That's how much money has been taken from us, taxed from us, through this hidden process. 9 cents left out of a whole dollar. Now, I say 1,000% inflation, that's known, because it's much more than that. Have you ever wondered, as I used to, why don't we have more inflation than we have had? I knew they were creating this money like crazy there. Why only this inflation? And then I found out. Have you ever heard the expression that we're exporting our inflation? Every once in a while you find that phrase in the financial section of the newspaper. It used to drive me crazy. How can you export inflation? It's one of those phrases that people use, and I'm not sure most of the people who use the phrases know what they mean. Like the other day I read that the Federal Reserve System bought dollars today to bolster up the dollars. How can you buy dollars, you know? What do you buy it with? Anyway, you need dictionaries to think. I'll just tell you on that one, they buy it with other currencies. The Federal Reserve holds a lot of different currencies, yens and Deutschmarks and that kind of thing. So they just swap currencies around. But this expression of exporting inflation, what does that mean? It means this. 70% of the currency created, American currency that has been created by our Federal Reserve System, is no longer in America. It's overseas. That's what they call the euro dollars and all of these foreign accounts and so forth. Other nations use American dollars as their unofficial money supply, especially those countries which have no realistic money of their own. These countries that undergo inflation rates of 5,000 and 10,000% a year, you can't work with money like that. Women have to take wheelbarrows full of paper money to the grocery store to buy a bottle of milk. You can't carry on any serious economic transaction with money like that, and they don't. They use American dollars. All the banks in those systems have dual systems and dual types of money. American dollars are the mainstay of the economic transactions in most of those countries. And that's where our money went, a lot of it. We have been spared the inflationary impact of all that money, because had it stayed here, it would have bid against the existing money here. It would have diluted our pot even more, and we would have known what the inflation should have been. What happens when the day comes when, for whatever reason, these countries can no longer or no longer wish to use American dollars? Maybe they'll have something else. What are they going to do with those dollars? Well, they'll send them back, won't they? They'll buy something with them while they can. I mean, it'll be a big rush. They'll buy whatever they can while there's still purchasing power left in them. You know, it'll be our refrigerators, our automobiles, our real estate, our high-rise buildings, our corporate stock, our politicians, whatever's for sale. And all of this money will come in, and then we'll find out in a very short period of time what the true inflation rate really should have been all of these years. And incidentally, if you followed in the newspapers the talk about the new money that they're going to release, they're talking about a two-tiered money, one for overseas and one for here. Probably be a different color. And frankly, I think they're recognizing this fact that money would return, and they're going to make it illegal for all this overseas money to come back. They'll make it a different color so that they won't be able to bring it here. Or if you do bring it here, you can't spend it here. It won't be legal here. In other words, all those poor people that are holding American dollars over there are going to get, you know what. Yeah. So, anyway, that's what they're talking about, and that's the reason for it. Okay. Those are some of the consequences of the actions of the Federal Reserve scam. I have one last topic that I want to talk to you about, and then I'll get to the conclusion. This is an extremely important topic, and it has to do with usury. In ancient times, usury was defined as interest on a loan. Any interest on any loan was usury. Well, in modern times, that has been redefined to mean excessive interest on a loan. Moderate interest seems logical to us in recognition of the fact that if we work hard for our money, we save it, we surrender its use for a period of time, that's a sacrifice on our part, and then loan it to somebody else for their venture, we're entitled to a reasonable return on that sacrifice. A reasonable interest rate is a concept that very few people have problems with. Seems logical and fair. But what is this thing called excessive interest? Thomas Edison said, "People who will not turn a shovel full of dirt on the project, nor contribute a pound of materials, will collect more money than will the people who will supply all the materials and do all the work." And I wondered when I read that if Tom was exaggerating, so I got my calculator out, and you might try this yourself. I assumed that there was going to be a $100,000 house built. I assumed that $30,000 would have to go for land, architect's fees and permits and that kind of thing. $70,000, therefore, would go for the actual construction of the house, the building materials and the labor. I assumed that the buyer would go to the bank, put 20% down, and then borrow the balance at 10% over 30 years. I punched in the numbers and discovered that the borrower will pay to the bank in interest $172,741 compared to $70,000 paid for the construction of the house. In other words, about 2.5 times as much money will be paid to the bank in interest than will be paid to those who provide all the labor and all the materials. And you may say to yourself, well, yes, but that's fair. After all, 30-year loan is a long loan. When people work for the money and sacrifice its use and loan it and so forth, they deserve to be compensated. No, not this money, ladies and gentlemen. Nobody worked for this money. Nobody saved this money. There was no sacrifice of any kind for this money. This money was created out of nothing. And I suggest that $172,741 interest on nothing is excessive. I think it's time for a new definition of usury, as follows. Any interest on any loan of fiat money, meaning money made out of nothing. But this example of a $100,000 home, as shocking as it is, producing $172,741 unearned interest, this is just a grain of sand in the Sahara. You have to multiply that by all the homes in America. A lot of them bigger than that. By all of the hotels in America. All the high-rise buildings, all the factories, all the airplanes, automobiles, farm equipment, everything, the schools, all the physical assets of America. You apply this same ratio, and can you see it in your mind? We're talking about a river of unearned wealth that is so wide you can't even think across it, flowing perpetually into the banking cartel, a dead short across the productive element of society, money being taken from people who are working hard, providing the materials and the labor. They don't even know that this is being taken from them, and it's in this huge river of wealth flowing into the banking cartel. It's a staggering thought. And you are led to the question, where is this river flowing? Where is it going? I get the mental picture that's all going into a lake somewhere. Maybe there's a dam and the wealth is building up here somewhere. It's getting it all. They're getting it. No. They're spending it. They're not accumulating it at all. They're spending it. What are they spending it for? The answer may surprise you. They're not buying more yachts and mansions with them, with this money. They've already got all of those could possibly want. In fact, they got rid of the mansions on Jekyll Island a long time ago because they were bored with them. That's not it. When a person has all the wealth that you could possibly want for the material pleasures of life, what is left? Absolutely, power. They are using this river of wealth to acquire power over you and me and our children. They are spending it to acquire control over the power centers of society. The power centers are those groups and institutions through which individuals live and act and rely on for their information. They're literally buying up the world, ladies and gentlemen, but not the real estate and the hardware. They're buying control over the organizations, the groups, and the institutions that control people. In other words, to be specific, they are buying control over politicians, political parties, television networks, cable networks, newspapers, magazines, publishing houses, wire services, motion picture studios, universities, labor unions, church organizations, trade associations, tax-exempt foundations, multinational corporations, Boy Scouts, Girl Scouts, you name it. Make your own list of organizations and you will find that this is where those people have been for many decades, spending this river of wealth to acquire operational control, particularly over those institutions and individuals, those organizations which represent opposition to themselves. That's a critical area for expenditure on their part. Now, this process has gone on not only to a marked degree in America and in the other industrialized nations of the world, but it has gone on in the so-called third world or underdeveloped nations to such a degree that I would say the process is now complete. It's finished. They own these countries already. Have you ever wondered what's going on there at the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank? It's kind of an obscure operation, isn't it? You don't read much about it. Except once in a while on the back page of the newspaper, you find out that Congress, at the insistence of the President, voted, authorized another $100 billion for the International Monetary Fund. And then the article tells you that this money will be used to make loans to underdeveloped nations or grants to them to raise their standard of living. Do you believe that? That's one of those appearances of the fourth kind, if you ever saw one. If the money is to be used to raise the standard of living of these countries, they're not doing a very good job of it, because after all of these decades and after all these hundreds of billions of dollars, you cannot point to one country that has had its standard of living raised one iota by that. In fact, most cases, it's the other way around. And that's not an accident, because the money has not been used to raise the standard of living. That's not what it was spent for. The money does not go to the people in those countries. It might have a chance of raising the standard of living. It goes to the politicians in those countries, to their governments. And the money is designed and spent to strengthen their power structures, their ability to control their populations. They usually start off as inefficient dictatorships, but by the time they get all this money from the IMF, they are now efficient dictatorships. They have a well-equipped army, they have a better bureaucracy, they have total control over their subjects. That's where the money's being spent. Now these... Pardon? Yes, ma'am. If you'll hang in there for just a couple of more minutes. I'm coming to that. Yeah, I'm not going to be one of those guys, I hope, with a non-solution here. But I do want to finish this part of the story. These countries have been purchased because the politicians in those countries are now totally addicted to this money. We talk about welfare families in America that are third and fourth generation welfare. They're on the dole forever. They cannot dream of anything else. The politicians in these countries are the same way. It's now second, third, and in some cases fourth generation international welfare from the United Nations funding. They have no ideology. Communism, socialism, capitalism, fascism, what difference does it make? Where's the money? As long as they live well, they have their mansions, their yachts, their limousines. They go to New York, to the UN, and have their suites at the Waldorf Astoria. That's all they care about. Ladies and gentlemen, these countries have been purchased through this means They are now owned by this group at the United Nations, and they're firmly in place in the New World Order, where they're just waiting for you and me to show up. And that's the other side of this coin. Not only does this transfer of wealth from America to these countries not raise their standard of living, but it does lower ours. And that, too, believe it or not, is part of the plan. Just waste, to get rid of money, to get rid of productive power, to reduce our standard of living. A strong nation is not a candidate to surrender its sovereignty, but a weak nation is. If America can be brought to her knees, where she is struggling for survival, if people are hungry, if we have riots in our street, then Americans could possibly be grateful for any assistance we could get from the United Nations. Those wonderful blue-helmeted peacekeeping forces could bring order back to our streets, or an international money, a new world money with purchasing power again, might be welcomed by the unthinking, unknowing American public. So that is what we're dealing with. What I'm trying to say is that the name of the game out there is not wealth, it is power. Now, what are we going to do about it? The first thing, and the most obvious thing, is we have to slay this creature called the Federal Reserve System. We have to abolish it, and that can be done. We got into this mess through Congress, and that's how we're going to get out of it, is through Congress. They passed the charter, they can abolish the charter. Our object is to build a little fire under those seats in Washington and make it a politically expedient thing for Congress to want to do. We've just started this campaign. Believe it or not, a few months ago, there were a few people that talked about the Federal Reserve System, but it was not an issue of public debate. There was nothing out there. It wasn't something that people talked about. You never heard a candidate talk about it, hardly ever. But already, in just a few months, with intense organized effort, we're able to inject this very issue into the political mainstream. And we've just started. It can be done. It's not going to be easy, but it can be done. It requires a clean sweep of all of those big spenders in Washington. However, as I hope our coordinator here will explain to you later if we have time, even some of the big spenders can see the light. As they say, they may not feel, and how does that go now? They may not see the light, but they can feel the heat, you know? That's how it goes. If we can elect good conservatives, be they Republicans or Democrats or independents, makes no difference, good Americans who understand the Constitution and money, then the others that are still there, the big spenders, will see the light. And I tell you, you know, they will do this because their finger is to the wind to see which way public opinion is blowing. And these guys are going to go around saying, well, I've been trying to warn my constituents for many years about this danger. They will. And all of this will not happen unless we have an informed electorate, ladies and gentlemen. We have to inform our fellow Americans about the true issues around us. And that's why you folks are here. It's why I am here. Because we all sense, don't we, that this is where it has to start. You can't step over that issue. Nothing will happen based upon voter ignorance. But how do we do that? Well, we need quality materials. Materials that are accurate, that look good, that you can rely on. Materials that you can't be embarrassed to hand to your friends. We need an organization that generates these materials and is capable of distributing them. We need leadership, above all, that has proven its ability to come up with something other than non-solutions, and especially leadership that is incapable of being controlled by the opposition. Now, the bad news is that time is running out. The New World Order is being assembled right around us. It used to be that when I spoke on things like this some years ago, people would look at me and say, what are you talking about? This would never happen to America. You're an alarmist. Now, you mention things like this, and people don't say that anymore. Generally, they don't. They say, how much time do we have left? You know? It's obvious now, isn't it? As we speak, Over half of our standing military is serving under foreign officers at the UN. Our military is gone. As we speak, they're getting ready to issue a world money system. As we speak, they're tooling up the world court, a world bureaucracy, a world tax, and a world police force to collect that tax. As we speak, time is running out. Now, the good news is, though, is that we still have time. Instead of complaining about the fact that time is so short and all these things are happening, we should thank our lucky stars that we still have freedom. We're still able to meet in a room like this. We're still able to go out and campaign. We're still able to find good candidates. We're still able to call in on the radio. We're still able to write letters to the editor in the newspaper. We're still free. We can pull it back. But ladies and gentlemen, whatever it is you plan to do for your country or your freedom, do it now. You must work as though your very life and your freedom depend upon it, because in fact, it does. And I think a good place to begin, sir, is to send Epictetus back to Phrygia and to convert that mammoth appearance of the fourth kind into a disappearance of the first kind. Thank you very much.